Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy. Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. Hey, how are you? I am good. And this episode, this is episode 100 of the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. If you had told me on March the 30th, 2021, when I put up two episodes of me rambling into my phone, two and a bit years later, I would have 100 episodes live. I would have over 100,000 downloads. I would have had an array of amazing guests. I would never have believed you. So this episode is a bit of it's two parts. One is that the gas man came, and two is 19 things I've learned in 100 episodes of Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. So the gas man, last year and the year before, has been a bit of a way of me assessing my progress, because under the law, every 12 months, I have to have a gas safety check, a gas service. And every year, it gives me a heart attack and a nervous breakdown and scenes of horror and devastation in my life. But since doing the podcast, I've been using it as a bit of a check-in point to see whether anything's changed since my previous one. And it actually happened a few weeks ago now, but I thought I would save it for episode 100 because I knew that that was going to be a bit of a review one anyway. So it seemed like better timing than to do an episode just for that. So as with every year, I got my letter saying the gas service was due and I had a crisis. But from there, what I see in terms of how I handled it is really, I think, improving year on year. First of all, while I still had to shift a load of stuff to make sure that the gas engineer could get to the boiler and the meter and all of those things, there was less to shift than in previous years, which is already a good sign. But I think the best sign in terms of, wow, I think I'm making progress. Certainly 2 years ago, it was all about move things from here to there so there's a path. And then last year, it was a combination of move things from here to there so there's a path. But there was also an element of what can I get rid of as well, rather than just moving things around. And this year, the big focus was what can I get rid of, with a lot less moving things around and a lot more, do I really need to keep this? And I think that in terms of where I would want to be with dehoarding and where seems like the healthiest place to be with dehoarding, I think is really preferable. there was a lot more like, I am sick of moving this every year when I don't use it in the meantime, or don't even really know it's there, or I constantly trip over it, or I drop things on it, that kind of thing. So like I had a bread maker that years ago I was obsessed with for a few months, haven't used for years and years and years, but kept in a kind of aspirational, maybe one day I will make bread daily kind of way. This year, when it came to moving it, I just thought, I know I'm never going to use this again. I know I'm not. I don't know where the instructions are. I don't know where the recipe book is. I don't really eat that much bread these days. And so the bread maker's gone. The bread maker has gone. The clothes dryer thing that collapses all the time and drove me mad, it's gone. It's just a lot of stuff I got rid rather than moving it to make space. And getting rid to make space actually makes space rather than just shifts things so it looks like you've got a bit of space. And I think that I was quite heartened to realise in the run-up to the gas man coming that that was more my approach. Another real positive is that the gas man has now been and gone, but I am continuing to make real progress in the kitchen. The kitchen has started to be a place I actually enjoy spending time in. I'm cooking more because my kitchen is a nicer place to be. I'm using parts of the kitchen I haven't used for a while. I've finally got access to my cupboards. As long-term listeners know, that my food, I had access to like the cupboards with plates and pans in and stuff, but the food cupboards, I had just got myself into a real tizzy. And I basically had full cupboards, and so started putting stuff in front of the cupboards. And then because there was stuff in front of the cupboards, I couldn't access the cupboards. So more stuff had to go in front, and I got myself into a real vicious circle. And then I came up with a kind of temporary solution where I had bags that functioned as cupboards. Anyway, I am finally in every cupboard in my kitchen. All the out-of-date food is gone. So the cupboards are being used for current food, which is, you know, what they're designed for. So that is massive progress. And I'm daring to think that I may be making progress enthusiastically. I'm not like, oh, I mean, I initially I was like, oh no, I've got to clear all the space for the gas man. But what it is now, the gas man's been and gone, I'm continuing to try to improve that space because I want it to be nicer, not because something's being forced on me. So that's really good. The actual deal with him coming was quite a palaver. I got a date from the landlord and I waited in and nobody turned up. And so I rang up and it was rearranged and I waited in and nobody turned up. And I rang up and it was rearranged and I waited in and nobody turned up. And it was really ridiculous. My adrenaline levels and my blood pressure, I dread to think. I was so stressed all day and in advance and then on the day, and then it kept not happening. And I was kind of losing my mind because on the one hand, I was so relieved that nobody came. On the other, I was really annoyed because I kept having to wait in and because I couldn't cope with that amount of tension indefinitely. And so every time it was rebooked, I was in this real cognitive dissonance of please come today and please don't come today. And it was exhausting. It was emotionally exhausting. And then on one of the many rebooked days, I got a text saying, I can't remember his name, but let's say Andrew is on his way. And I was like, oh, is this actually happening? And I shared a screenshot of this text with various friends, and we were all like, come on, Andrew, you can do it. And I think I was so, like, I had burnt up so much nervous energy over all those previous dates that I fully did not believe that Andrew was going to turn up. And then Andrew turned up, and I was, again, cognitive dissonance. Thank goodness he's here, and oh no, he's here, all in my head. And I never know whether to, like, do I apologize for the state of the place? Do I ignore that? Do I, you know, how do I handle that? But I think I just said something like, sorry for the mess. And he came in and he was, you know, he did the service and he was very chatty and friendly, didn't say anything about the mess. Didn't, you know, he just chatted like I assume he would chat with all of his customers. And so it was actually, he did it all good and left. And whew, it's done for another year. Got that drama again next year and every year. But I did it. It went as well as it could have. If he was judging me, and I expect he was on some level, that didn't come across. He wasn't critical. He didn't say anything rude, or he was just chatty and friendly. And importantly, it's done. And importantly, I continue to make progress in that part of my house. So yay. The listener voicemail segment has a monthly theme to help you think of something to say. So for July, the question to answer is, what is a lesson you've learned recently? Maybe you've learnt that avoiding certain shops helps you to keep your acquiring under control, or that the world doesn't end if you run out of something you thought you needed. This is your opportunity to share your learnings with us. Have your say with your voice. If you want to record a voice message to me to potentially play on a future podcast episode, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail and leave a message. The topic for July is a lesson you've learnt recently. Let us know what you're thinking at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail. So, through doing this podcast, I have learnt a lot of things. I have changed in a lot of ways. And for the last few weeks, I've been noting down things as they occurred to me that I have put, that stand out as things that I have learnt through the course of doing this podcast. And the first of those is that there is power in talking about difficult things. The reason I started the podcast was because I had nowhere to talk about this, and I didn't know how to talk about it or who to talk about it with. So I talked about it out loud to myself, but recording it and uploading it. And to my great surprise, you all tuned in bit by bit and you started contacting me. And I've learnt that there is power for me in talking about this thing that I'm so ashamed of. And every time I talk about it, albeit anonymously, I break some of that shame. And one of the most powerful things that listeners have said to me over the course of it is that I'm helping to break down the stigma of hoarding disorder. And if I can do any of that, that is incredible, because I firmly believe that the stigma of hoarding disorder makes it worse for everybody. It's why we don't ask for help easily. It's why we don't get help easily. It's why we might isolate ourselves and never talk to anybody about it. And so there's power for me personally when I talk about this. But there's power for all of us when we talk about this. Anybody with a stigmatized mental illness, anybody with a difficult problem, anybody whose clutter has got out of control. When we talk about difficult things, that's powerful. The second thing I've learnt is that experimentation and curiosity are powerful. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about this because I dedicated the whole of episode 98 to talking about curiosity, and I kind of said a lot of it then. By the way, I'm going to be mentioning various previous episodes in this episode, and so I will make sure I link to them all in the show notes, which is going to be a challenge. But the show notes can always be found at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk, and you just find the relevant entry. So this one will be for episode 100, and all the links I mention are at the top there. So rather than talk too much about it, given that I talked about it extensively in episode 98, I am going to play this clip now from episode 45, which also covers why treating things as an experiment and treating things with curiosity is powerful. I am a perfectionist, and I do like to do things right, and I do worry about doing things wrong. Whereas if I frame it as an experiment, if I frame it as, let's see what happens if I do this, or let's be curious about what will happen if I do this, then it doesn't feel like a success versus failure situation. It doesn't feel like I'm either going to win or I'm going to lose. It feels like, let's see, with no judgment either way. Experiments sometimes work and they sometimes don't. That's the nature of an experiment. And if I can tackle my house in that way, then I don't go into it with these great expectations of perfection. Instead, I go into it with, well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. The third thing I've learned in 100 episodes of this podcast is that there's power in being able to laugh at yourself. Some of this stuff is funny. I mean, in its ridiculousness. Some of the things, if I open a box and I look through these things that I've stored for maybe 20 years, and I just think, why? Why have I had this in my house, taking up space? Why? It makes no sense. Even I can see sometimes that it is absolute nonsense and it's funny. I'm not saying laugh at hoarders. I am not. But I am also saying it doesn't all have to be super serious. And if we can see the light side of something, it can really break the tension. And I've got a couple of clips I want to play you, but I also want to tell you that sometimes when I'm editing the podcast, I save the outtakes and the bloopers. And sometimes I put them on TikTok, and sometimes I put them on the end of the episode, right after the outro, after like the end music. And so after the outro this week, I have a blooper supercut with a mashup of lots of my bloopers, and Jan features in quite a few of them as well. You will not be surprised to hear. So that's one area of being able to laugh at yourself. But I want to share a little clip of a stand-up routine now. And there's this comedian called Joe Wells. He is talking about a tip that his wife was given for anxiety, and it really made me laugh. Have a listen.
She's a very anxious person. She was given this tip. I'll share this with you now. This is not a joke. This is a free anxiety tip. If anyone gets anxious, you can use this in your life. She gets intrusive anxious thoughts that bad things will happen to people she cares about. She was told, if you have an intrusive anxious thought, what you can do is you can sing that anxious thought out loud to the tune of a silly pop song. That makes the thought seem ridiculous, and it diffuses the power of that anxious thought. Not saying it's fixed everything. She still gets quite anxious, but it's a little thing to do. She's found that helpful. Like I said, not a joke, just a free anxiety tip. It's been genuinely helpful for my wife. What it has meant for me is that occasionally I'll be woken up in the morning by my wife singing Joe's gonna die in a terrorist attack. A terrorist attack. He's never coming back. And that's bad for my anxiety.
Now there's another comedy clip from Radio 4 programme called Mock Steals in Town, where a comedian called Mock Steal goes to various under-celebrated places around the UK and does a stand-up show, basically laughing at their town. And he is talking, so this one is in a place called Kingston-upon-Thames, and how this New Malden, the area he's talking about, has the highest population of Korean people outside of Korea, and which is very interesting and quite fascinating. And he talks about a Korean tradition, and all I could think when I was listening to it was how difficult this must make the life of hoarders who live in New Malden. I don't know if I have any listeners in New Malden, but if so, let me know. Anyway, here's Mark Steele.
And something else that can be seen peculiar if you come to New Malden is the Korean habit of giving you gifts. You can leave a restaurant and you just get given a present. Now, this throws English people of my generation. I mean, in an English caff, if you went in there and they went, there you go, white bacon, egg, beans, chips, sausage, mushrooms, mug of tea, that'll be £5.90, love. And then gave you a lampshade, you'd go... Going in there again, they're a front for drugs. I got a message on Twitter from a Korean, says the Koreans in New Malden love giving stuff away. I once got given a pack of crackers when I bought a skirt. It must be exhausting. Every time you wander outdoors, you're going to have to go with a shopping trolley. Oh, no, I went in the post office, I got given a bath mat. I popped in the shop for a packet of biscuits, was given a chest of drawers. I just have to carry piles of stuff around all day to give to other people as well. Oh, no, someone's asked me the time. I better give him his shoes.
I mean, what do you do? Presents are hard. Presents are hard. The fourth thing I've learned since doing this podcast is that perfectionism is not an admirable trait. I don't think I would have ever said I thought it was, but I think somewhere quietly inside me, I kind of thought it was a good thing to be a perfectionist. And I definitely was and am a perfectionist. And it wasn't something I particularly tried. I knew it sometimes got in my way, but it wasn't a priority in terms of the multitude of things I had to deal with. It was quite low on my list. And then Dr. Jan Eppingstall and I did an episode on perfectionism, and it really shifted the way I thought about my own perfectionism, because the way that she described it was that perfectionism is essentially a form of rigidity. And there was something in that word that, whereas I wasn't that bothered about being a perfectionist, I definitely didn't want to be rigid. That's not the kind of personality I've tried to cultivate in my life. It suddenly seemed like a really unappealing trait. But it's not just that word. That episode and kind of the research I did around it really showed me that perfectionism isn't just that I get annoyed if I don't do something perfectly. It really, really trips me up. It stops me making progress, like, to quite a considerable degree. And I think I hadn't fully grasped that until we did that episode. And it was genuinely helpful to me, and really kind of shook me out of a bit of complacency I had around the whole idea of perfectionism. The fifth thing I've learned is that there are reasons for hoarding behaviours, and if we ignore them or dismiss them, it's harder to make progress. Because as much as we can try and do the surface stuff, we can try and make decisions about what we want to keep and what we want to get rid of. We can try and do the practical stuff of actually keeping or getting rid of those things. But if we're only operating on that surface level, then the same roadblocks appear again and again and again and again. And it's only when you start digging a bit deeper and you start to see patterns and you start to understand what's going on, understand why you freeze whenever you try to tackle a particular room, understand why you can't make decisions about your old school stuff, why you feel compelled to hold on to everything, why this is so difficult for you. If you're not looking to some degree into what's actually going on, then the same issues repeat and repeat and repeat, and it's really hard to break out of them. The sixth thing I've learned is that we sometimes have to get a bit creative with our strategies. I think I've really grasped that nobody can come in and tell me exactly how to do this, because I have to work out what works for me, and I can take guidance and I can get ideas, and those things are invaluable. I'm getting tips and tricks all the time off other people. But if I don't do them my own way, they don't stick and they don't work. And sometimes what works for me is the opposite of what will work for you, and vice versa. And that's fine, because as long as we work that out, we can make progress. We can do some actual de-hoarding and do some actual work on our brains, on our thoughts and our emotions to make progress. And so sometimes we might have an approach that doesn't even make sense to other people, but if it's working, then it's working, and it doesn't matter that other people don't quite understand why. So it might be that somebody suggested to you, always keep your keys and your handbag and your face mask by the door, ready to go. You won't ever lose them again. But actually, by the door is one of your most chaotic parts of your house, because you've got a habit of coming in and just dropping whatever you're holding and getting on with your evening. And so it might be that for you, it makes a lot more sense to keep your bag and your keys and your face mask in the bathroom or by the toaster or somewhere that it wouldn't make sense to other people. But if there is a logic that works in your brain, doesn't matter whether that is the same logic as would work in somebody else's brain. What matters is that it works. And so if you hear a tip and you think there's something in that, but that wouldn't work for me because X, Y, Z, then don't be afraid of twisting it and turning it and bending it until it turns into something that does apply in your life. As a fun example of that, I have a clip here from episode 83, and it's about a French writer called Victor Hugo. And I hate how I said his name in this clip, but here you go. A novelist called Victor Hugo, and he was apparently a big partier. He loved going to parties, and it was stopping him from writing his novels. And so what he apparently did was lock up his party clothes, his formal dress, so that he couldn't go to whatever exciting society party was going on that night, because all he kept was a grey shawl, nothing else. And so until he completed his book, he wasn't allowed his smart clothes anymore. And it was through doing this that he wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is, you know, obviously an epic masterpiece that has stood the test of time. The seventh thing I've learned since doing this podcast is that asking yourself strategic questions goes a long way. I have whole sets of questions that I ask myself in different circumstances to help me decide what to get rid of, and also what to bring into the home. So I have a set of questions that anybody can get for free on my website, that are questions you can ask yourself when you're trying to make a decision about an item. Some people say, like, if you're tempted to buy something, you might want to ask yourself, where would I keep it specifically? Or what specifically will I get rid of in order to justify bringing this in? It's that kind of thing. And I find them so useful as a way to really kind of laser in on the issue. And I've recently come up with two new ones that I ask myself when I'm tempted to buy something. And these are, the first one is, am I buying this to solve a temporary problem, especially a temporary problem that will go away when I've cleared some space? So I talked a few episodes ago about how I was doing all this weird creative stuff to solve problems caused by hoarding. And I was doing all of this stuff rather than just de-hoarding the space. So I had a light bulb that I couldn't access because of stuff. And so I was getting all these different lamps and positioning them in certain ways to try and light that space. And so in those circumstances, when I was buying yet another lamp to solve this, the question, am I buying this to solve a temporary problem, especially a temporary problem that will go away when I've cleared some space? The answer to that would have been, yes, I am. And then I would have had to rethink, because alternatively, I could just clear that space and solve that problem without having to buy anything. And the second new question I'm asking myself when I want to buy something is this a complete solution to the problem I have, or does it solve part of it, leaving me with more to acquire to fix the whole thing? And this came to me when I was replacing the clothes era that I threw away, because I hated the clothes era. It collapsed all the time. It was too big. And so I decided I could replace it with a smaller one. And when I was looking at alternatives, I kept spotting things that I would think, yeah, that would kind of do, but I realized would not be a complete solution. It would be, I would buy that and then I would go, oh yeah, but I still need this. And I would have ended up buying multiple things, none of which quite fitted the bill, and all of which would end up taking up more space than the original and probably being more annoying. And so what I did was I just spent longer looking until I found the perfect solution for me, which was one that goes over a door so it can flatten to be flat against the door, or you can kind of pull it out and there's rungs to hang up your clothes to dry. And for me, that was a complete solution. And it was not to fix a temporary problem. This was a long-term solution. And so for that purchase, I could answer those questions honestly, saying I'm not buying it to solve a temporary problem, and it is a complete solution. But I've found myself, since I've come up with those two questions, now when I ask myself them, when I'm tempted to buy something, it's actually interrupted quite a lot of purchases and made me think, ah, well, in that case, I shouldn't get it, should I? I should clear the space instead, or I should at least look for a complete solution and not try and bodge together multiple partial solutions that are never quite adequate. And I've also got a clip here from episode 43. If you hadn't come across this item right now, would you have ever missed it? The answer to that will sometimes be yes. It might be a cherished letter from a grandparent who died and you've been desperate to find it for years, and now you've found it and it's precious, brilliant. But a lot of the time, the answer is no. Like, I remember finding some perfume body spray, and the smell of it immediately took me back to a particular really happy time in my life. And I thought, oh, I've got to keep this because it's such a nice reminder of those sunny months when things were pretty chilled and happy. But then I realised that if I'd never come across that item, I wouldn't have ever felt sad for not having found it. I had no idea that I still owned it. So the eighth thing I've learned is that beating yourself up is not the motivator you think it is. I have had a lifetime of beating myself up, and it's a very hard habit to shake. But I have also, at the same time, had to come to terms with the fact that much as I tell myself I'm doing it for my own good, the reality is that I'm doing it and it's not helping. It doesn't make me make better progress. In fact, if I'm really, truly honest, beating myself up prevents progress because I end up feeling miserable, unworthy. And so rather than taking positive action, I curl up in a ball. And rather than thinking I deserve a nicer space to live in, I'm thinking I deserve less and less and less because I'm so terrible. And so I have had to come to terms with the fact that while this knowledge has not stopped that kind of ongoing dialogue in my head about how terrible I am, it's not stopped that, I have at least had to stop pretending that it's in some weird way helpful to me. This is a little clip from episode 81. If you're like me, you're quite self-critical and you find it hard to give yourself praise, but find it very easy to yell at yourself when you don't do something to the standard you want to or imagined you would. And you can argue as much as you like that it helps to motivate you. Telling yourself off kind of keeps you on your toes. And I think it can do occasionally, but I think the bigger picture is that more often it's demotivating. It does not do anything to help you. It just piles on reasons why you are not good enough, you're not a good person, you're not good at this. And all of those thoughts make you miserable. The ninth thing I've learnt from doing the podcast is that hoarding affects people beyond just us. Hoarding can affect our neighbours. It can affect the people who love us. And in particular, if we have children or if we have people who we live with who depend on us and our hoarding imposes on their lives, that has a really, really detrimental and negative effect. Because I don't have children and because I also don't have parents who hoarded, until doing the podcast, I'd never really thought much about the impact on children, I have to admit. And there's a group in America called Children of Hoarders, and I've had such useful and valuable conversations with them. And it's really highlighted to me how oppressive it is to live in somebody else's hoard, especially when you're in a position where you can't leave. It's oppressive enough living in your own hoard, but if your parents value the hoard over you, that is absolutely devastating to a child. And I've interviewed two children of hoarders on the podcast. One was a woman called Elizabeth Nelson, who was actually the first interview I did on the podcast. And the other is a woman called Tracy McCubbin. And Tracy is now a professional organiser. And the psychology of that is really interesting. And we did talk about that when she was on the podcast. I'm going to play you a clip here from episode 79. This was an episode that I did with Dr. Jan Eppingstall, regular guest on the podcast, where we were addressing, in particular, listeners who hoard, who have children, and have a listen.
But whatever the state of your relationship with your children, you need to seek help for yourself and come to terms with the impact that your mental illness has had on your family. there is a way back, but you have to do the work. You can actually repair relationships, but there has to be, you need to do the work. And your children also need to seek treatment, because there is no doubt that this experience has significantly impacted their emotional growth. And it has the potential to negatively influence the lives of the next generation. So if you're able to step up and say, I'm seeking to change, then perhaps your children will not pass that trauma on to your grandchildren. I think that's one of the things that's really important for us to realise, that this transgenerational trauma, now we understand it.
And this is super difficult stuff. I'm not pretending any of it's easy. But if you do have children or other dependents living in your home, it's easier to ignore it. We must face the reality of what we're doing and be responsible and be accountable for our behaviour. Our illness is not our fault, but the way it affects other people can be so devastating that we do have to take it into account. The 10th thing I've learned is kind of related to that, and that's that we need to respect other people's space, including not offloading our stuff onto them or overwhelming them with gifts. Here is a little clip from episode 34. If you give it to your brother and he puts it in the bin, then it's in the bin. If you give it to an animal shelter and they put it in the bin, then it's in the bin. If you give it to Oxfam and they put it in the bin, then it's in the bin. So the key is to put it in the bin yourself and not force other people to be part of this dysfunctional chain, because you're creating work and costing people money. And I know that all sounds harsh, but these are things that we have to be aware of, especially if we're at a stage where we are trying actively to de-hoard our homes. I might be making it sound straightforward and easy, and I absolutely do not think it's straightforward and easy. I don't find it straightforward and easy myself. It's so complex and so difficult. We can't declutter our own space by cluttering up other people's spaces or making it other people's problems. That's not resolving anything. And the 11th thing I've learned, related again to that, is that you can have boundaries when other people try to offload their stuff onto you. It's hard when somebody's trying to force things on you, especially if they really, really want you to keep it. But have a listen to this little clip from episode 31. You might think, I wish I could make use of my grandparents' cabinet, but you can't. And that's okay. That's okay. Your home does not exist to hold on to the ghosts of everybody you've ever met, or every dream you ever had, or every purchase you ever made. To quote Elsa, let it go. It's uncomfortable, it's difficult, but you can't save everything. Let's talk secrets. I keep my hoarding secret, and I often wonder about the effect that these secrets and this shame have on us and on mental health. To start breaking the taboo, I want to hear your hoarding secrets to discuss anonymously on the podcast. I've created a form to submit your secrets anonymously. I won't know who sends what. If you want to tell me your secret for a potential future episode, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/secret. The 12th thing I have learnt from doing the podcast is that therapy is good. There are good therapists in the world, and some of them are specialised in hoarding. Some of them are not, but can still be excellent allies and excellent helpers. But it relates to what I was saying earlier, that we kind of have to understand our patterns and we have to understand the reasons behind those patterns if we're going to successfully overcome compulsive hoarding. I want to play you, it's a longer clip than I normally do, but it deserves to be heard in its entirety. And it's from a podcast called Blind Boy. And it's a really beautiful meditation almost on the benefits he's noticed since starting therapy. Blind Boy podcast is unlike any other podcast I've ever listened to. It's fascinating and funny and moving and lots of things. This bit, he's talking about therapy, but he's also talking about vicious cycles and virtuous cycles. As I said, it's longer than usual clips, but it's worth every minute. Warning, it is a bit sweary, so if that bothers you, skip forward.
So as you've been aware, if you've been listening to this podcast for the past 5 or 6 weeks, you know that I've returned to seeing a therapist. I now see a therapist once a week, and the experience has been fantastic. I'd say I've seen an improvement of about 70% in my overall emotional well-being. And mostly what that looks like is I have a clear emotional dialogue with myself. I have greater emotional literacy. When I feel something, I can label, notice, and name what I'm feeling and allow the emotion to process through me without using defense mechanisms. And because of that, I'm able to be emotionally regulated, which means I'm kind of calm all the time. I'm calm all the time, and when I'm not calm, it's for a good reason. So when I'm not calm, it's because I receive upsetting information, or because something stressful happens, or because I get a little fright, or something happens that angers me, and then I react emotionally in that moment, respond to the situation, but then afterwards, and this is the important bit, I go back down to being calm. So I'm spending much more of my day in the here and now, in the present moment. This then improves my confidence, my self-esteem. I've got much greater self-discipline, which is something I was really looking for. For the first time in 2 years, I've really started to feel excited about the book that I'm writing. I'm not afraid of it. I'm not worried that it might be shit, because when you think that way, you get writer's block. Instead, I'm just like, I'm really excited about writing this book. I can't wait to see what stories are going to reveal themselves to me. And when I think like that, then I can achieve creative flow. That's the opposite of writer's block. If I have to do a piece of work now, and I feel a bit distracted, I feel like going online or looking at my phone. When that happens now, I'm actually able to say to myself, no, put your phone away. You need to do work now. And I put the phone away and I do it. And then I feel a sense of achievement. And this is happening because I believe my internal voice now. Because I have good dialogue with my emotional world, and because I'm not emotionally reactive to things. So when I say to myself, you need to put 1 hour aside to do this piece of work, I actually believe myself. I believe myself when I say it and I do it. And then that improves my self-esteem, and it's a positive spiral. Whereas before, I wouldn't really understand why I'm feeling like shit. I would just generally feel on edge. And I wouldn't understand why I'm feeling on edge. I wouldn't really even be aware that I'm on edge. And then what I'd do instead is I'd doom scroll on the internet and procrastinate and engage in self-soothing behaviours. My sleep has improved massively. I'm able to say to myself, go to bed now. It's 11 o'clock. Go to bed. Go to bed now. Because if you go to bed now, you're going to feel good about that in the morning. And then when I say to myself, you're in bed now, get your phone and put it on the other side of the room and don't look at it until you wake up the next morning and read a book instead. And I do it. And why do I do it? Because I believe my internal voice. Because my self-esteem is better. Because the way I speak about myself to myself internally is better. When I tell myself to do something, I have confidence in my own internal voice. I do what I tell myself to do, and then I reap the rewards. And the rewards of put your phone on the other side of the room, read a book and actually go to sleep, the reward of that is a full night's sleep and then waking up the next day with a sense of accomplishment. Now, I don't know how much of this shit is regular mental health issues, or is it my autism, executive dysfunction issues around autism, but to be honest, it doesn't really matter. Here's why something as simple as going to bed, telling myself not to look at my phone and not doing it, here's why that's important. Because 6 weeks ago, when my mental health wasn't in check, here's what I would have done. 11 o'clock would have struck, I'd have noticed it, and I'd have said to myself, it's 11 o'clock, you should probably go to bed now if you want a good night's sleep. But I'm anxious and I'm worried, and my self-talk is very bad. My opinion of myself is quite low. I'm very self-critical. So when I say to myself, it's 11 o'clock, you should go to bed, I don't listen to myself. I make excuses. I get distracted. I scroll the internet more. Now it's 12:30 and I feel like a failure. Because an hour and a half ago I said, you said you were going to go to bed at 11 o'clock. Now it's 12:30, you fucking useless piece of shit. You can't even go to bed on time. Now I'm going upstairs to bed at 12:30, feeling like a piece of shit because I couldn't even make myself go to bed on time. Then I say to myself, it's 12:30. Put your phone at the other side of the room so you can sleep. Then I don't. I go onto TikTok and I scroll and scroll. Now it's 2 in the morning and I come out of TikTok and I go, you fucking useless cunt. You said you were going to go to bed at 11. You couldn't do that. You said you were going to put your phone on the other side of the room. Instead, you looked at TikTok and now it's 2 in the morning and you failed at even trying to go to sleep. I'm overtired. I finally do go asleep. I'm going to sleep with a bad attitude. I'm going to sleep without confidence in the process of sleeping. Then I have a shit sleep because I'm going to sleep anxious. And then I wake up the next morning early with a jump scare, having just had 5 hours sleep. And then wake up feeling like a failure because I failed at sleeping. And checking my Fitbit to use data to confirm what a shit sleep I had. And looking at the Fitbit and it says, poor sleep. Now I've just woken up, feeling shit about myself, and the wonderful, beautiful day is ahead of me, and instead of embracing the day, I've started off feeling like a piece of shit, but I don't really have the conscious emotional awareness to know why I feel like a piece of shit. I've just woken up feeling that way, but because I don't have emotional literacy or a good dialogue with my interior world, I've woken up feeling like a piece of shit, so now I look for the reason why I'm a piece of shit. I go straight onto fucking Twitter before I've had my breakfast and find some people who are saying mean things about me, believe that, and then spend the rest of the day feeling like a piece of shit and repeating the same cycle over and over again, continual excessive stress and everything that goes along with that in between. All the middle of that day, feeling bad about myself, so viewing the entire world negatively, then viewing everything throughout my day with that lens of negativity, searching for the reasons why I'm a bad person or why I'm useless or why I'm a failure. The simple act of saying to myself, it's 11, go to bed, put your phone on the other side of the room, actually do it. The act of doing that, then going to bed, reading a book, not fucking my eyes up with a bright blue light, and then falling asleep at like 12, then waking up the next day at 8 with this beautiful feeling of accomplishment because I just told myself to do something last night. I listened to myself and now I'm rested. What do you think that does to my day? I feel positive. I feel like I can accomplish things. I woke up this morning having gone to bed last night at a reasonable hour and reading a book instead of looking at my phone. Then I woke up after 8 hours of sleep, and what did I say to myself the second I woke up? Don't check your phone. Don't check your phone. Don't check your emails. Don't check your Instagram. Don't check anything until you eat your breakfast, meditate, and go into the office. And I did it. And then what happens? My journey into the office was fucking magnificent because I'm not thinking about emails. Something hasn't upset me before I've eaten my breakfast. I was able to mindfully enjoy my cycle into fucking work. There's wonderful cold weather here at the moment. It's fucking freezing, but because my mental health is improved, I've got a better dialogue with myself. So when it's fucking freezing, what do? I put on the right shoes, double pants, gloves, the right jacket, a hat. Now I'm prepared for the weather and I'm having a lovely mindful cycle into work. Then I get down at my desk, I open up my laptop, I open up social media. And shit that would bother me on a bad mental health day doesn't. I still see the negative comment on Twitter. What happens? Oh, that's someone else's problem. That has nothing to do with me. This person doesn't like me. That's got nothing to do with me. And I leave it at that and I forget about it. The email comes in from my agent or something going, you've 6 of these gigs that you have to do. Can you respond to all these emails from the promoters? I need it done in the next 2 hours. Yeah, I can. I just do it. Boom. Out of the way. I don't get so stressed out that I don't do it and I procrastinate and now I feel like a failure for the rest of the day. So that's what mental health recovery looks like. For me, I'm becoming a much more effective human being and I'm viewing the inevitable stress of life through a calm, rational lens where I can think critically. If emails come in asking me to do a shitload of work in the next 2 hours, I look at it critically. I acknowledge that the work is stressful, I'd rather do something else, but I also acknowledge that it has to get done, and I do it, and it's done. I don't view it with an emotional lens, I don't catastrophize, I don't personalize when a stranger on the internet thinks that I'm shit. It's not pleasant, but it's also not really my problem. I haven't done anything to the person, I haven't hurt them, I haven't said anything mean to them. Their dislike of me is none of my business, it's their problem. This is all happening because I have a clearer emotional dialogue with my internal world. And like I said 2 weeks ago, what that is for me is I'm allowing myself to sit with sadness. When I see something sad, I experience the sadness of it and I have a little cry if that's what I need to do. And I'm becoming aware that sometimes I use anger as a way to protect myself from experiencing sadness. And what that looks like really is, it's just mindfully saying to myself when an emotion pops up, what's this? What am I feeling here? Let's stop what I'm doing right now. Whatever I'm doing, let's stop what I'm doing right now. And let's investigate this emotion that's coming up for me. What's this? Am I angry? Am I sad? Let's notice this and feel it. And I'm able to do that because I'm attending therapy. Once a week, I get an hour to speak with somebody about whatever's bothering me. Just to speak. And emotionally, what that is it's like I'm unclogging a drain. It's like I'm unclogging the drain of my emotions once a week by speaking with a professional. And once I unclog that drain for that 1 hour once a week, I'm leaving the therapy session with unblocked pipes. So when an emotion comes up for me later on that night or the next day, there's no backlog. The emotion comes through by itself and I can see it and notice it and sit with it and process it healthily. My tools are returning. I did the hard work. I did the hard work years ago through 3 or 4 years of therapy and my tools are returning. I'm learning how to cycle the bike again, how to drive the car again.
The 13th thing I have learnt is that when you don't know where to start, remember that it's most important that you start. Many of us, definitely myself included, procrastinate starting because we feel like we have to start in the perfect strategic way and we don't know what that is and so we don't start. And what I've learnt, what I say to myself now when I have a I don't know where to start moment is it all needs to be done. So just start in front of you. Just start where you are. And whether that's you have never tried to dehoard anything and you don't know where to start at all, or whether it's I'm trying to do this box and I don't know where to start, whether it's massive scale or small scale, it still applies. It all has to be done, so just pick something and start. If you have a particular part of your home that drives you mad, sure, start there. Makes sense. If you have a particular part of your home that you have to clear because of external pressure, then sure, start there. But if you're just floating, going, there's so much and I don't know where to start, just pick anything. Doesn't it? The most important thing is that you start. The rest of it will work itself out. It all has to be done. So start wherever you are. As I said, I've regained access to my cupboards, and I'm now in a position where I have to transfer stuff from one cupboard to another cupboard. And one thing that always makes me freeze is logistics. If anything has more than a couple of steps, I freeze and I panic and I don't know how to do it. And so I'm going, I need to get stuff out of the first cupboard and into the second cupboard, but there's some stuff that has to get out of the second cupboard first, and there's stuff in the way that will go into the first cupboard when I've made space, and I shut down. I can't cope. And so this is a very current example, although I have these all the time, but this is just one that came up today. And so I was in the kitchen looking at the cupboards going, how do I do this? Logistics scare me. I can't cope. And then I thought, you know what? I'll just start getting things out of the first cupboard and putting them in a bag so that I can move them over to the second cupboard easily, and I'll work it out. I'll start and I'll work it out as I go. This is absolutely radical for me. I am not a start and work it out as I go kind of person, but I am learning all the time that sometimes you just have to, and sometimes it's the most efficient way to do it. Even if you think the efficient way to do it will be to plan it perfectly in advance, sometimes the efficient way to do it is to just muddle through and work it out as you go. And that is a massive revelation to me that I have learned from the podcast. The 14th thing of 19 that I have learned is that what we bring in is just as important as what we get out. I think I was in denial about this to some degree before. I think I knew that I had too much stuff and I knew that I needed to get rid of stuff, but I hadn't fully taken on board that I was also bringing far too much in. And it's something I still struggle with for sure. It's a real weakness of mine. But through doing the podcast, I have absorbed that ignoring the problem of bringing things in is counterproductive. And if you're getting stuff out with one hand and filling that space instantly with the other, you're just on a roundabout of futility if you think you're clearing space. And it's hard. There are so many shiny things. There are so many beautiful things. There are so many worthy things, and I kind of want them all. And doing the podcast has made me address that, even if it's an area that I still stumble on. The 15th thing I have learned is that it is absolutely fine. Oh, 2 years ago me would not believe I was about to say this sentence. It is absolutely fine to make mistakes, get things wrong, change direction, and change your mind. There are things that we think will work and they don't. We think, if I do this, then that will happen, and then it doesn't. Or there are things that do work for a while, but they stop working, either because they stop being effective, or because we get bored of them, or because we finish a task. And there are also things that work in one part of your home that don't work in another part of your home. And having that flexibility of allowing yourself to do things that may not work perfectly, having that flexibility to say, okay, I made a plan and I tried it, didn't work, what shall I do now? Rather than ploughing on because that's what the plan said. or having the flexibility to say, I was wrong, I got that wrong, I thought that I was wrong. It's hard, but it stops us from getting stuck in a rut that does not serve anybody, least of all us. This is a little clip from episode 61. Because if you're too set on a particular course, what I've found is that if it looks like it's going wrong, or if it looks like you won't achieve what you'd hoped, it's too easy to abandon the entire thing altogether. By embracing partial solutions, embracing imperfection, if things don't turn out quite like you'd hoped, or like you'd imagined, or if things change course, it won't throw you as much, and it won't make you want to throw in the towel as much. You're not invested on the plan that you thought would work. You're invested in a process that improves over time. The 16th thing I've learned is that things can actually change. I embarked on the podcast in pretty much a state of despair. I did not know what to do. I could not have felt more stuck. People say to me, if they listen from the beginning, listeners say, it's so amazing to hear like the change in your tone and confidence and attitude as the episodes progress. And this is that. This is because the work I've been doing, both on the podcast and in my head and in my home, is showing me bit by bit that things can change. I was so convinced that this was just my lot. This is just how things are. This is just my life. It's miserable, but it's how it is. I had no clue how to address the problem. I had no belief that if I did address the problem, I would have any success. And I had no belief that even if I managed to get a completely normal home, I had no sense that I would be able to keep it that way. And so I was so downtrodden and stuck. And through doing the podcast, whether that's talking to inspiring people on the podcast or in messages, whether it's the research I do for episodes, it's bit by bit given me these little injections of possibility that this is not an inevitable thing for the rest of my life. And I did not have that at the start. And now I do believe that change is possible because I'm doing it, and a lot of you are doing it. This is a little clip from episode 87. This, the way we live, hoarding, living in a hoarded home, all of this, there is nothing inevitable about it. This is not the way we have to live forever. This is not our destiny. And it can feel like it. That helplessness is strong. It can feel like we're fighting a losing battle. It can feel like we've lived like this for so long that this is just how we live. This is just how my house is. This is, you know, when I go into such and such a room, I have to step over a box. That's just how it is. It's inevitable. But the truth is, it's not inevitable. This is not inevitable. This is not our destiny. The 17th thing I've learnt is that there are not many people working well in this space, but that some of those who are exceptional people. I spend a lot of time reading research papers about hoarding, and I see the same author names again and again and again and again. But the people who are doing good work in this space are doing such good work in this space. And I've been lucky enough to talk to a number of them. And they wouldn't all say they specialize in hoarding, but with different specialisms and different focuses, but real dedication and insight into the area. It provides a landscape where there's better understanding, there's less stigma, and there's more hope. So I've put together a mashup of just some of the guests that have been on the podcast and some of their incredibly wise words.
One of the things that I really feel about this is that your experiences have shaped how you perceive the world and those in it. You know, you might be distrustful of people and this stops you from connecting. And I want you to know that there are trustworthy people out there who want to connect with you. It's great to have animals and maybe a soft toy to cuddle when you feel alone, but more is not better. You can't rescue everything. Saving the world one object at a time will not save you. And I've mentioned this before, I think, but empathy is stepping into another's shoes and feeling, thinking, experiencing what they're going through. But compassion is taking the perspective of that other person, animal, living thing, understanding it and wanting to help. That's additional. We need compassion for others and turn that compassion inwards. But you are worth saving. Just as worthy as our environment, just as worthy of love as those bugs, plants, animals in your backyard. You can receive love as well as give it. And that's what I want you to take from this research and from this podcast.
Research shows that no matter where you're at in the world, no matter what your mental health background is, your socioeconomic status, people have intrusive thoughts. They've actually done research to show that if we get someone who has OCD and someone who does not have OCD, and we ask both of them for 2 weeks to write down all their intrusive thoughts, that you can't discern at the end of the 2 week period of who has OCD and who doesn't.
Wow.
So it just goes to show that, like, we all have the same thoughts. Like, there are other moms out there who had all the same types of thoughts that I had, but where people with OCD go a little bit different is that they tend to think that those thoughts are significant somehow.
I was at a book event once, and this woman said, and I'd never heard it so clearly, she was wrought, and I don't know, something like 4 people in her life had died in the last 2 years, like just like unimaginable. And she had these storage units, and it was full of all everybody's stuff, and she was paying all this money out. And she said, you know, I just am so tired of being a museum for the world. And I was like, right. Yeah. You know, and the thing to remember about this is that a lot of times we actually don't want the stuff. We don't want to lose the connection. That person was dear to us. And we, people have said this when we're decluttering, or especially if it's got somebody's handwriting on it, they're like, I feel like I'm losing them all over again.
How can grief or bereavement lead to somebody hoarding or to somebody's hoarding worsening?
Yeah, loss is often raised by clients and people I've worked with as a catalyst for the emergence of hoarding behavior, particularly saving possessions. But equally, I hear that clients may have had a number of losses close together, and they find their hoarding behaviors intensify. Like, they might have lost a parent, then their marriage broke up and a pet dies, you know, all in a short span. And for anyone, these multiple losses would be that would be a difficult reality, but most people struggle. A majority would find their way through the stages of grief and reach acceptance and kind of use adaptive sort of skills, like talking about it or journaling or, you know, just allowing time to heal and seeking help kind of if they felt that they were still grieving after 12 months or so. But people who are vulnerable to hoarding, it's kind of inevitable that they'll use saving and acquiring as one way to kind of manage these acute emotions. It's just their go-to coping skill, so or their coping style.
And the truth is, like, one day I will die and this shit will go to a landfill. Like, housing it temporarily in your house for 25 years doesn't prevent it from going to a landfill.
Something I said on an episode ages ago was, the question is, does it go to landfill now or does it go to landfill in 20 years. It's not whether it will go to, and some, I get emails still saying that point has changed my life.
Exactly. And the thing, and even more than that, the question is, will it go to a landfill while I live a functional and joyful life? Or will it go to a landfill while I live a life where I'm not functioning and I feel guilty and I am, you know, living under this burden? It's like this thing, like the destiny of this item is the same, but the destiny of you is not in either of those scenarios.
What I have found as helpful is to have a deeper conversation. So there is a reason that the person who is having trouble letting go of things, there's a reason that that there's meaning that they're assigning to either the item, the process of letting go of the item, what it could be a fear of the future, like am I letting go of a legacy of where that would go, or it could be holding on to the past. And usually the other partner really needs a lot of help and support in understanding that, because it takes time to really structure a dialogue for the couple where I'm helping them slow down and listen a little bit more deeply.
I do think that we can reframe it. I think some acceptance that we made a mistake is needed here too. We can't change what we've done in the past. It might not have been a mistake, in fact, to buy or acquire the item. We may have needed it at the time and actually used it, but keeping it longer than we needed it and losing that valuable living space was the mistake, I think. And being able to accept that it's been a waste all these years. Really, if I part with it now, I'm able to gain something from that parting. It's okay to admit you were wrong in your decision to keep it. You thought you were doing the right thing and now you know better. It's okay to change your mind, and it's okay to decide now rather than before. You weren't ready before. You're ready now to kind of reclaim that space, and that kind of reframing, I think, is important.
I feel like we know shame when we feel it, but I struggle to describe it. So what would you say shame is?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think a lot of people would struggle to define shame and kind of name it precisely. So to me, shame is, it's a type of emotion or affect, and it's usually called a negative self-conscious emotion. So what that means is that in every shame experience, we have an experience of self-consciousness, which means we have the sense or feeling that we can see ourselves from another person's perspective, and that other person, and that could be a real person, or it could be like an internalized person, or it could be something like God, like an ideal person, that person is judging us negatively. So if I see shame as a kind of umbrella term that captures a whole range of experiences where we feel that we are being judged negatively by another person or a group, or even by like an internal standard that we hold, and that negative judgment will compromise our sense of belonging and connection. So what that means is shame is an experience where we worry that we're going to be negatively judged, or seen to be worth less than others. So it might be that negative judgment is just simply like you're not valued as much as others. And that as a result of that, we might be rejected or not liked or ostracized or kicked out of the social group. So that's what I see shame. And that, for me, it's like shame is an umbrella term that covers a whole range of experiences. So it could be things like embarrassment or humiliation or mortification. Those are kind of cognate emotions that we would recognize as shame emotions. But then experiences like being disrespected, being ridiculed, being put down, being made to feel like you're not worth as much as others. So there's a whole range of experiences where you have this negative self-conscious experience where you feel like others are judging you in a particular way. That means that you're being marginalized or rejected or kind of put into the out group rather than being in the in group. So it's a huge terrain of experiences as far as I'm concerned. And like, I'm a philosopher, and in philosophy of emotion, there's a big area of research to try and like precisely define these emotion terms. So how is shame different from guilt? How is shame different from embarrassment? And I just think, I don't think there's any point. I mean, it's interesting, kind of intellectually interesting, but I think when we're thinking about how we actually experience these emotions, it can be very blurry and a lot of overlapping experiences. You can feel embarrassed and guilty at the same time, or embarrassed and shamed at the same time, or you can live with different types of shame that mean, you know, they're experienced very differently.
But often we do a behavior because it settles down an emotion that can make us feel more secure, less vulnerable, safer. So you'd be wanting to think about which emotion it's soothing and helping people put in place other strategies. Because if you're going to take away one behavior, which would be the hoarding, you have to, if that's meeting a need, you need to be replacing that with something so you're not leaving people without useful tools.
But the way that I look at hoarding is you've got these different components. It's almost like a recipe, and you throw in, you know, you've got some sweet stuff and some sour stuff, and you just throw in, you mix it all together. And one component is this inattention aspect, which you can call, you know, difficulties organizing, difficulties making decisions, concentrating, all those things that I referred to before. And there's lots of them, but they're all kind of under that umbrella of inattention. And I think if you do have problems like that, then it will increase your chances of eventually having clutter in your house, maybe having to go through, you know, documents accumulate in all our lives. But you need that wherewithal and say, right, I'm sitting now and I'm sifting through all this pile of mess and I'm going to organize it and not let it, you know, get ahead of me. And that does require something that I think many people with ADHD would find challenging.
It's all about that balance, isn't it? It's, you know, all or nothing is just a roller coaster. And we need to kind of have that balance between cost and benefit. And I think, you know, we need to weigh up what feels good to us versus what is good for us. And that can be really hard because we have to dig deep and look at things, and we actually have to turn internally and see what's happening. I do bang on about values, but this is central to understanding what is good for you. Is this purchase a vote towards the person I want to be, as we've spoken before? And values are kind of a shortcut to decision-making, because we can look at that purchase and say, are you representative of who I'd like to be moving forward? And the answer usually is a quite clear yes or no.
The 18th thing I've learned is that de-hoarding is hard, but not de-hoarding is hard as well. I didn't de-hoard for so long because it was hard, but I underestimated how hard it was to live in a hoarded home. Have a listen to this clip from episode 51. De-hoarding is hard. We might not know how to do it. We might not have the energy to do it. We might get overwhelmed and all of those things. It's hard. But you know what else is hard? Having crap to step over every time we want to go into a certain room, or having to clear stuff out of the bath when we want to have a bath, or having to empty the oven of pots and pans before we can turn it on to cook our food, or having a mini heart attack every time somebody knocks on the door and we don't know who it's going to be or what they're going to want, or not being able to sleep in your own bed because there's so much on it, or not being able to have your own grandkids round for tea because it's not safe or because your kids won't let that happen. And the 19th thing I've learnt, perhaps the most surprising of all, is that people do want to listen to a random hoarder talking about her life. Over 100,000 downloads of me talking about hoarding. It blows my mind, but I must be doing something right. And I'm so grateful to each and every one of you for having the faith in me to keep listening. It blows my mind, and I appreciate every review, every rating, every message I get on social media. All of it is genuinely surprising me daily. And it's corny, but I couldn't have done it without you. I make this podcast because I think it's important. I started it as an outlet for myself, but it's become much more than that. And I hear from people all the time about how listening to me talk about my experience and interview specialists and experts is helping them. Hearing those stories makes the time and cost absolutely worth it. But if you want to help to ensure that the future of the podcast is sustainable, you can donate to help with costs. To send a one-off or recurring donation, just go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/donate. Thank you. So my top tip this week is from the Eco Chic podcast, which I will link to in the no doubt extensive show notes this week. And she is talking about buying things on sale.
I don't know who needs to hear this, but if you are buying something on sale that you weren't originally going to buy, you're not saving money. You're still spending money. The tip here is to stop letting yourself believe that you are getting a good deal or that you are saving money if those weren't items you were thinking about in the first place. It's really easy to justify an impulse purchase based on the sale price of that item. However, again, if you weren't already thinking about buying it, you're not actually saving any money. You're just spending money. Once you start checking yourself and how you are reacting to sales and how you think about sale prices, it's a lot easier to stop yourself from overbuying. It's a lot easier to make sure that if you're only spending X amount of dollars this holiday season, if you have given yourself a budget, that budget is going towards things that you genuinely care about, that the people that you're giving gifts to are genuinely going to enjoy.
It's true, isn't it? Now, don't forget to stick around after the end credit. End credits? Who am I crediting? Myself, I guess. After the outro for the bumper outtakes. But thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast. I always say, what is that beeping? Making an effort to insert the immediate, the negative automatic, I think less weird than it might mean than I can't dishoard this house. Dishoard? What? No. If this thought was true, no. Is actually connected to thought processes is... But even when I had some success like that, I would stick for it. So this week's top tip is a few seconds from a really interesting podcast called Maximized Minimalist. So I will link to the Maximized Minimal. A plane van. It was just. And it was clear, oh, for God's sake, say that I let it build up again. And I regret that I let it build up.
I mean, grief is like a normal reaction when we lose a lot.
Whether they're hoarders or not. Oh, God, how many times are we going to trip over the word anthropomorphism? That's the question. Like we should do vocal exercises or something. Thank you, Jan. You are always a...
bright spark in the podcast calendar. I started a sentence with no idea where I was.
And then I snorted.
I'll try that again.
Tension around those inconsistencies of our beliefs.
People who hoard often cite not wanting to damage the relationship. No. Freud. What relationship? I'm really interesting. I'm not really interesting.
Yes, you are.
So something as simple as secreting. Where can they do so?
You can.
Brilliant. Thanks ever so much.
Okay. Right. Let's go. Okay. My top tip. My top tip today is how to. Hang on.
So I am here today with Dr. Jan Eppingstall, an American? Since when have you been American?
Never, sister.
What happens
sometimes if a New Zealander, you can throw that in or wherever you like.
Antipodean.
Antipodean.